This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Welcome to a bonus episode of the Nerds Podcast number 502. We're going to get right into this. Not going to promote anything. There's no sponsorship spot. We're going to get right into this. Game of Thrones is premiering tomorrow, as of the time that this goes up. And so we thought it'd be fun to have kind of a Game of Thrones themed episode through the lens of... through an academic lens. We thought it'd be fun to do a Game of Thrones episode through an academic lens. There's a guy named David J. Peterson. He created the Dothraki language for Game of Thrones. He creates fake but real sounding languages based on real language rules, but then just with fake topping, just so that, you know.
I love making fake languages. I do it all the time.
Make one now.
Tell me a phrase to say.
I'm sorry, sir. We're all out of pizza. Would you care for this cannoli? I think you're using nachnest in the wrong... I think there's a little bit of a syntax problem there. Oh, well, you too. There are way more syllables than that. I mean, there are way more consonants than that.
I think that was like only letters that aren't used in the... that's one of my favorite things to do is to try and scatting with only consonants. Try it.
I think a joy buzzer is really like scatting with it. So here's David J. Peterson in a bonus episode of the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 502.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
We have a guest here, guys,
and we're
We're
just talking about old Monty Python things. Although, do you know what we're talking about?
No, I will tell you this: I now know that the name Toad the Wet Sprocket
is a Python reference.
Yes, mm-hmm. I know that because I lost at our weekly trivia game yesterday.
They're really pulling out some timely references.
Wait, what was the question?
Oh, it was band etymology. So they were like, you know, here's the band name. Where did it come from?
Oh, wow.
Multiple choice or
some of the other ones?
No, there was no multiple choice. Gotcha. It was just the first one was where Steely Dan came from.
It was a vibrator, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. From Naked Lunch, and I take credit on that one because that's the one where I actually read it. Then there was because I read Naked Lunch. Let's see, there was Radiohead, which is from the the Talking Heads.
Yeah.
Let's see, I'm trying to think of the other ones I got.
Lady Gaga on there.
Katy Perry.
It's a nickname, right?
No, she got it from Queen, Radio Gaga.
Oh, I thought it was a nickname because of her name.
Gaga Goo.
Isn't her what's her last name?
I don't know. Italian.
Yep, her name is Nicole Italian.
Yep.
Gaga Goo.
What is that Italian? That Gaga, ga, ga, whatever you guys are saying. Oh, that's pretty good.
I thought her name was just Violet Gaga.
It was Violet Gaga. Yes, the. But can I say that I miss Toad the Wet Sprocket? I really liked that band when I was younger.
Weren't they playing when we were in Dallas last time? And I was saying, like, and some guy was like, you know, if we go now, we could probably catch the last part of their set.
Yeah. What?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that we had to say hi to fans. Ugh.
Jonah, we're recording.
Oh, sorry.
You can't let people know your true feelings.
We had to say hi to idiots.
Jonah, that's what? Way worse.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You're trying to figure out how to one-up that one?
Yeah, yeah. We had to say hi to fucking morons. Throwing up.
That was a little much, the throw up at the end.
You know, Jonah.
I had to one-up it.
What that could have used is a fake language.
Good seg.
Sweet! David nice. Peterson.
I think the seg would have been when we were talking fake Italian. But
shit.
That's just me.
Why didn't you jump in, David? That was the perfect opportunity.
Ah, molto bene.
Molto bene.
Hey, that's real. Stop it.
That's real. Stop saying real languages.
Molto banana.
No. It's fake when I say it because I don't speak Italian.
Gotcha.
Get it?
Molto bene.
Yeah.
What would fake English sound like?
There's a great video.
Yeah.
The guy who's an Italian. What's the name of the dude?
I can't remember, but it's he's doing just
right.
English gibberish.
I sent it to you.
Okay, you've seen it.
Yeah.
All right. So then we all
that's
know
what it would sound like.
We all know what we're talking about.
You know who's amazing at that is Reggie Watts. Reggie, I've seen in his
amazing
act,
is the word for that. Okay.
Go through this whole thing where he'll it's like it's French and then it goes into like Russian and then Italian and then but it's all gibberish, but it sounds the cadence of it all sounds and the word forms that he's using all sound like he's speaking, and he speaks really fast, so it's good. So you should look up Reggie Watts.
All right, I like that.
Cool. How many? So you're essentially you create fake languages for film and television, and how much? So first of all, let's start with what have you created? You created Dothraki, right?
Yeah, I did that one. No, that'd be funny. You get me here. No. No, I just edited the scripts.
What? That's it?
No. But yeah. Dothraki for season 3 of Game of Thrones. I did High Valyrian, and then a language descended from it, a Low Valyrian variant, and then for Defiance, Castathan and Arathiant.
Wow,
Defiance on Sci-Fi. I don't know if anybody watches it. It's cool.
And I'm positive that people who are listening, some of the people listening, watch Defiance.
Bless you, all of you.
So, were you a linguistics professor?
No. Okay, so I went to college to be an English major because that's what I wanted to do. And then I kind of fell into linguistics, mainly on my mother's urging, kind of to get her off my back. I took a linguistics class, and I kind of took to it.
She wasn't satisfied with the English?
No. Okay. Who would be, honestly?
Yes, but why do people use the words that we use?
You know, the thing that I really liked about it, if you're an English major, all of your classes are the same, right? You're reading stuff. You're discussing it, and then you're writing long papers about it. So then when I got to linguistics, and it's like, here's your homework, and it was like an actual sheet of paper. And I was like, wow, there are problems in here, and they have to do with language, and it's this easy? It's like, my goodness, this is just heaven. And so I just kept up with it. And it continued being just easy and fun, and then, you know, progressively harder. Then I got to graduate school and realized, oh, they actually want you to do research, and like that's what you're supposed to do. And I was like, anyway.
So what made it up?
So how do you?
I wish.
So how do you go from that to like what?
Oh yeah. So yeah, I was creating languages the whole time. So when I started with linguistics, that was when I started creating languages.
That was your Kaiser Sose. I've been creating languages the whole time.
I mean, you know, it was just, I don't know, it kind of hit me when I was taking my first linguistics class that I could create a language that was just for my personal use. Because, you know, I was familiar with Esperanto and Volapük at that time. Volapük is an Esperanto. Well, it came before Esperanto, but it was terrible. And the guy who created it was a nut. Esperanto was much more successful. Those were created for international communication, but I thought, well, I could create a language that's just for my personal use. And I thought that I was the first person ever to hit on this idea because, you know, back then the internet was still small. Anyway, and then I just, I started it and I was like, oh, wow. After like a few years, I realized, wow, I'm just doing this. Like, this is what I do when I'm not doing anything else. Well, okay, I guess. This is going to be the rest of my life.
But what do you do? Do you teach someone else your language, or was it just No. To have private conversations with yourself about
okay,
things?
Okay, yeah, that was at first. At first, I had this girlfriend that I don't have anymore. My idea was that I would create this language and we would speak it with one another. Yeah, and
just to piss people off in public because they didn't know what you were saying.
Yeah, and
it's a good way to make fun of people.
Yeah, but yeah, when I presented it to her, she was like, "Oh, that's cool," and that was the end of that. Didn't work out.
Did you break up with her in your language?
Oh no, no, that one was in English. Oh, what an ugly day that was. Ah, oh, poor girl. Anyway, but
let's
you know
go
what,
back there
you know
now.
What, she's as far as I know. As far as what I can glean from Facebook, she is in a nice, stable relationship with a guy that looks like much more of an adult than I do. So I think she's quite happy. So I'm feeling okay there.
Well, I'm glad to know that Facebook had a use in that case that seemed relatively positive.
And that does it for our Facebook check-in with ex-girlfriends.
None of my ex-girlfriends are on Facebook.
That's what you think.
Well, or they're married.
Lisa Loeb's fan page is very active on Facebook.
Oh, my goodness.
All right.
I was... Lisa Loeb, oh my God. Like, she was just like the pinnacle for me when I was in junior high. I was like, this is the hottest person I've ever seen.
You should high five Chris right now.
Yeah.
No, let's calm down. Let's all just take a step back.
Then there was Daria.
Actually, let's just, Matt, take a step back.
Then there was Tina Fey.
Tina!
I got to
say. It's quite the gap between girls.
What? No, Tina Fey was.
Well, Daria doesn't age. He's a cartoon.
Yes.
No, but also, Tina Fey was on SNL.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, that was when I...
But not until, like, the...
It was when I was in high school, so it could only have been, like, 3 or 4 years at the very most. But she was doing the weekend updates.
That's right. Yeah.
So you went from Loeb to Faye.
Yeah. Then I got married.
What? So you did. You married. You got a wedding ring on. You're married
there. Yeah.
Could be a secret wedding ring. He only uses for himself.
It's possible.
I want to try to understand... How someone creates a language that, it seems like one of those things that most people go, oh, how fucking hard is that? Blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And then you realize, like, no, actually, you still have to get, because I studied, I went to all boys Catholic school, so I studied Latin, which, you know, my thinking was, oh, if I ever want to learn another Romance language, I'll have a really basic understanding of how to do that, and it'll make that a lot easier because it's much more complex. Yeah. And, in theory, that would have been helpful had I gone on to learn other languages. Actually, I did study Italian in college, and that made it tremendously easier because
all the
forms are a lot simpler than they are in Latin. And so it's like, oh, okay. But I will say that studying a language like that is, you know, 54% the basis of our language, even though you're going to have to explain to me why English is a Germanic language, but over half of it is Romance based.
It's just words.
Okay, so but the idea of it being that you understand so much more about your own language when you have to learn another language,
right?
Because you don't think in terms of like conjugation and subjunctive and you know all these different tenses and until you have to learn another language.
Well, not only that, the first time you learn a second language, that's the very first time you see that that language could possibly be different. And this is one of the tough things, especially whenever anything about language comes out in the news. People like, well, especially Americans, where a lot of English-speaking Americans are kind of monolingual.
You go to Europe and it's no big deal. Everyone speaks five languages. Right. And then here we're like, I can say some words in French. And then the rest of the Americans are like, you're so continental. And like,
escargot.
Yeah, it's good.
Oh, gosh. Anyway, where was I? Oh, right. So, yeah, you figure out that other languages can do things differently. And then, you know, it's at that point that you realize, well, if they can do this differently, they could probably do lots of other things differently as well. And so you start to it just really kind of expands your mind. And I think really the most important part is learning the first second language, because after that happens, like, well, it doesn't surprise you if other languages do things radically differently, because now you know that's a possibility. Beforehand, language is synonymous with whatever your first language is, and often it doesn't occur to people that languages could do anything differently.
I would imagine that English is probably, like, spoken English is probably the hardest language to learn because so much of it's colloquial and there aren't really specific rules for things. It's like, oh, this is just sort of this sort of memed through, you know, and became colloquial, and there's not really a...
Scottish people like doing crazy, though. Well, like Scottish people, because they just have a lot of their terms are just rhyming from something that like they're rhyming off of something they're referencing.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
Scottish rap.
Yeah,
Scottish rap.
Well, it's like, you know,
about.
When Kumail went there, he said like, you know, it's like a lot of people just will just like they'll say things, but they'll just they won't be saying the word they mean. They'll be doing the rhyming word for it.
Right.
Well, in English, it just depends. You know, if you change the way that you're learning things. So, like, a lot of times in English, you know, it's not sufficient simply to learn a verb. You have to learn a verb and its you know, concomitant preposition to figure out how it works. So, you can learn a word like, you can learn a verb like pick, but that's not going to, you have to also learn, you know, pick out, pick on, pick up, pick at. And then it's all, in all its various contexts. Pick off, you know.
What's the easiest way to learn a language? Just to be speaking it?
Rosetta Stone.
No.
This episode was brought to you by Rosetta Stone.
Don't give them free plugs until we have a stack of Rosetta Stone CD-ROMs.
Oh, here's Rosetta Stones.
Here's my free plug. I think Duolingo is better. It's a new online thing. Basically, it treats language learning almost like a video game. You can level up and stuff. And
Duolingo?
Duolingo, yeah.
All right.
It's pretty cool.
Done. I mean, fucking Japanese is next.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I think the best way, if you really want to learn it to fluency, you got to just go there and use it. One of the most difficult things, I think, especially for you know, a lot of people that take second language courses in high school, is there's really no motivation for using the language, and so it kind of just remains dormant, and sometimes, you know, your fluency can fall off. If you don't have a reason to continue to use the language or anybody with whom to speak it or any practical purpose for it, it just kind of goes into the part of your brain where trivia goes. And you know, language, just like anything else, it's patterns of, you know, repeated patterns of usage. And so in order to get better and better at it, you have to keep doing it and doing it. It's kind of like, you know, like older, especially older video games, you know, like side-scrollers, Ninja Gaiden type things. Like, if you ever sat down with one of those now after you haven't played them for a while, it's like, oh my God, you just die again and again and again until eventually you learn, okay, at this point in level one, I got to and then it's like,
you find the patterns.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think one of the hardest thing is that once you've already sort of solidified your main language, and then someone else starts teaching you another language, you're not associating those foreign to you words with objects. You're going, oh, agua means water, which is this thing. Like you're not going straight to the referent, you know, like you're processing it through this other part of your brain to get through the language that you already know to then anchor it to the thing.
Right. Yeah. And the one of the tough things is that teachers always tell you, it's like, I'll tell you, don't do that. You know, don't translate to English, but it's like, it's not super helpful. You can't just tell somebody, don't do that. And then it's like, oh, all right. It doesn't work like that. Usually, I think the thing that works better is to just do it in context. So, like, you know, it's the same thing for if you are learning a new game and, you know, there will be words for particular things that happen in the game. And suddenly you'll just be, you know, you'll just be using the new terminology because you know exactly what it stands for in that context. And I'm kind of
like,
you know, along here because I'm trying to. Oh yeah, that was a word I didn't know. That's
BioShock
funny.
Infinite Vigors.
What? Wait. Are you talking about the Vigorish? Because that's a word I didn't know.
No. Okay. Vigors in BioShock Infinite are basically they basically give you powers. They're basically these elixirs that give you powers, and so
they give you vigor.
They give you supernatural vigor. No, they're not. They're not called Vims. they're called Vigors.
Dianetics and Scientology, they made up a lot of terms too. There's a lot of terms in there. You have to learn them when you work at the ArcLight.
It's not they, it's one guy.
Yeah. Oh yeah, when you worked at the ArcLight, you had to learn a bunch of that stuff.
Qual. Right? It's the essence of the environment.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's why managers are not managers, they're QCs, qual coordinators. They help coordinate the essence of the environment.
So creating a language much in the same way that you wanted to have this mini community with your significant other. I mean, the importance of having a language is do you think is also to keep outsiders on the outside, basically?
Well, it depends, you know, why you want to create the language for. So that's one of the purposes for creating a language. Except that the people that I know who have gotten the furthest with it actually kind of hope other people will speak the language. There are some people I know that are fluent in their created languages. Their vocabularies tend to be the largest.
This is so interesting. I never thought of a bunch of people like trying to create their own languages and then getting them to spread. It's almost like.
It's not
trying to create a viral video with words.
It's not something that will enjoy a lot of success, but it just depends on what they want. So, you know, like when I'm creating a language, like for a show, obviously it's a different purpose. It's almost like a piece of the setting, except it's the linguistic setting. It's filling out that background, and so everything that I do is to make it authentic within that context, you know, as opposed to learning it, which I don't, which I'm really lazy and bad about. So Dothraki, but I can't.
Is there an ethics to language creation? Like, is there any sort of, you have a responsibility as someone who's creating a language to do this or this or this?
There ought to be.
Really?
So most of the time when people were hired to create languages, it was the first language they'd ever created in their life. They'd never, ever heard of the idea of creating a language. But often the level of sophistication of those who are asking for the language is so low with respect to language that, you know, pretty much anything that they were going to come up with would be fantastic. I came from a different background. You know, I came from the language creation community where there's thousands of us, and we all really just communicate online. Nobody really knew that other people were creating languages before the internet. So this is, the community is a really recent phenomenon from the early to mid 90s. And basically, you know, once people started communicating, they started looking at other people's work. They started learning from it. They started getting better and better at it. And so, our thought is, you know, when you're trying, when you're put in a position like I am, you know, you do the best job possible. And that entails using some of the skills that we built up, using some of the skills that we've learned in order to produce a quality product so that, hopefully some point in time in the future when the entire world is just, you know, really, really, you know, good with looking at a language and telling its quality, they'll be able to say, yeah, that one was good.
Do you think it's possible for someone just to invent a language right now and then all of a sudden that actually becomes a language that is, I don't know, I guess I just think, well, there's a bunch of languages that are sort of grandfathered in, and then we sort of have the ever-evolving colloquial language. You know, just the way that, you know, I know the way we speak now is different than the way we spoke 50 years ago.
Well, don't languages just stem from isolation anyway? I mean, out the spread and communication of people, I mean, just we couldn't travel very far, so we had to all talk this sort of, you know, and then as traveling, I feel like...
Do you see the Blade Runner thing happening where there's the language of like a mishmash of English and Spanish and Japanese and...
Well, no, I don't see that happening.
A replicant would never fool him.
I do see what will happen is that there will be, you know, languages that... it's happening already. There are languages that are dying off by the dozens, you know.
Yeah, I was listening to a story recently, and it's like a remote part of... India, northern India, and it's just an entire language all into their own, but there's not that many people who are, you know, learning it. It's just like kind of like the grandparents all know it, but it's like everyone's kind of assimilating out, and so there's like people there trying to just transcribe the entire language just so it's not lost forever.
Yeah.
I mean, Hawaiian could easily go away. The amount of people that know Hawaiian.
And we'd be better off for it.
Hawaiian, come on.
Hawaiian's still enjoying a lot of success in certain places like Niihau, but... so what happens, you know, like when a language dies, let's say, like Ayapaneco in Mexico, what happens is that, you know, originally you have a huge community of speakers. And the reason is that it dies is because that language becomes economically not disadvantaged, but not advantageous. So, you know, as people need to... start working, they need to, you know, take care of their families, they need to get jobs, there's probably going to be a larger community somewhere else that they're going to need to go to where everybody speaks one language. And so what happens is people slowly drop off and start learning the other language, and there becomes no economic motivation for them to maintain their own language. And in fact, often if you hear from the speakers of dying languages, you get a lot of what we hear in reverse. So, you know, people will say, oh, this is so sad. Languages are dying off. Every single day we need to do everything we can to preserve them. But you go and talk to those speakers, it's like, well, why would I speak this language? I have to earn money. And so, like, you know, well, at least if we're talking about Ibanico, that means I have to learn Spanish.
Right.
So why would I bother spending all this time maintaining and learning this language that I could only speak to with my grandparents when it's not going to be of any practical use to me? And so, you know, yeah, there are linguists then that go and preserve the languages, which is great for us in that. But it's not like... It's a different type of saving. So it's not like it saves the language. It preserves it the way you can preserve a butterfly by sticking a pin in it.
When does a dialect become a language, or is that not how it works?
There are tests that you can tell, basically, if two languages are mutually intelligible enough to be considered dialects of the same language or separate languages. But it's not as if there's any hard and fast, you know, cutoff point where you say, well, one word above this and they're dialects, one word below and they're different languages.
It's sort of like how a horse can fuck a donkey. And they can produce an offspring.
Yep.
But like a donkey can't fuck a horse.
Exactly the
no,
same.
No, the donkey can fuck a horse.
Well, my biology's with me.
And anyway. They create this hybridized, like, basically, it's like they obviously had a common ancestor, and they're still close enough on the tree that they can procreate, but they're not so close that it's, you know, the offspring is still going to be a little strange because it's not, you know, like, they're not close enough.
Yeah.
So they're still viable together, but not so viable that they could, you know, flourish together as a new species.
Yeah, I was trying to think of examples here. You know, obviously, take, you know, London English versus Southern Californian English, and, you know, we can understand each other, but they're, you know, clearly different dialects. But then something like Catalan and Castilian Spanish are just... They're just slightly too different that they're different languages. There's the mutual intelligibility. It just doesn't work as simply as it would for somebody from Southern California and somebody from London.
Well, I just remember going to different parts of Italy and just remembering some of the basic Italian that I remembered. And I'd go to one region and they'd go, oh, no, you say it like this. And I'd go to another region and use what they said. And they'd go, no, it's like this. And
isn't it easier just not to travel?
Yep.
Very
that's
much.
The
Myra method.
I mean, I think
that's what Epcot Center is for.
Really,
you know that.
Better be taking notes on these Myra method tips because
Twitter does it for me.
There's a book's worth in the
Twitter
in
does
the
it for me.
375 podcasts we've done. You have a book just waiting.
I know.
No, that'll never come out.
That's actually chapter
using
one.
The Myra method.
It's chapter one of the Myra method.
This book is not out.
So, what is the hard? What do you think?
You're reading this. I failed at chapter one.
What is the hardest language to learn, and why? Do you think?
Oh, it's there are languages that will be harder to learn. It's based on what language you know. So what your first language is, for example, like, you know, if you're a native Georgian speaker, it's probably pretty easy to learn Abkhaz. But for us, learning Abkhaz is, you know, pretty hard.
Yeah.
What a nightmare. So, like, you know, for an English speaker, hard will probably be something that's just really...
An Asian language, since it's it's completely separate?
No, I think we'd have a pretty good time learning Mandarin or any dialect of Chinese. I think English speakers would probably do well with it. The writing system is daunting, so I recommend not learning it.
The Myra method.
I'll learn one or the other, but not both. That's my rule when it comes to Mandarin. I'll learn how to write it or how to speak it. But Japanese would be tougher than Chinese, most certainly, for an English speaker. But something that would be really tough would probably be one of the Inuktitut languages, one of the Eskimo languages. Yeah, that'll probably be one of the toughest ones for an English speaker.
Is it because of where, like, how the sounds are produced in the mouth, or?
No, like, come on. People are going to be better or worse at pronouncing a language, and that's kind of a separate challenge. But no, it's the structure of the language. Inuktitut, you know how they say that it's got, like, 100 words for snow?
Right.
Yeah, really, it's just got, like, one word for snow. And what happens is you start adding inflectional suffixes on, and you could have, like, you know, snow, and then snow plus a suffix means fake snow. Another one means, you know, hard snow. Another one means, and you can have, like, a single word that means, you know, the really sleek and slippery snow that I slipped on when I was hunting caribou with my friend the other day, and that's a single word. It's
that's
just
the unproduced sequel to Hard Rain, Hard Snow.
That's right.
It's just a really, really very vastly different way of conceptualizing how you, first of all, communicate, how you put sentences together, and how you just formulate thoughts. That's really alien to what English does.
Oh, I feel like I remember that. You know, there was a semester in high school when our Latin teacher wanted us to learn some ancient Greek. And he said, you know, he said ancient Greek is much harder than Latin because for that specific reason. He said that there are words and for really specific, like, you know, a bead of water that you'd find on the top of a leaf in a certain part of the year, like, you know, that it's that specific that it makes it really, really hard to learn.
Oh yeah, I'm learning ancient Greek now. I avoided it for a long time. I'm learning Attic Greek specifically. It's been misrepresented.
How so?
In the media, I'll say that. It doesn't have a middle voice.
God damn it.
It doesn't. Linguists listening to me, shame on you. It has no middle voice.
What's a middle voice? For the people listening that don't know.
This is what I... Okay, look.
Oh, it's good that you bring them in, Jonah.
Yeah.
This is what I think a middle voice is. So when you say like something like, you know, the eggs cook up nicely, that's a middle voice. It's like the eggs are the subject, they're also the object, and they're not really doing anything. But it's not, you know, in English, it's not something that we have separately. It's just it's just something that we do. In Attic Greek, at least based on my recent, and I will say semi-unprofessional opinion, it looks to me like it was an old reflexive that's just enjoyed greater and greater use as Greek age. And in fact, it looks a lot like, if you study African languages that have a dedicated reflexive, it looks a lot like what they do. I don't know. But they call it a middle voice.
So you have an active voice where the subject is taking the action, taking the verb of the action.
And then
you have
a passive
voice where the verb is, where the action is being done to the subject.
Yeah.
So middle voice is just like nothing's really happening.
They're trying to say it's something special, this middle voice. But I am saying that even if the middle voice exists in some distinct and morphologically, you know, recognizable way in some language, it's not in Greek.
That's it.
Yeah.
You are really planting a flag today.
That's
Dave.
Right, I am. Everybody fight me. Come to Twitter.
No, go ahead. You're
good. How many African languages are there?
Oh, I'll just like two. No. No, there's gosh, how many African languages? More than 1,000. Some of the biggest groups, well, you know, Arabic is spoken in Africa, but it's a Middle Eastern language. It came from the Middle East. There are the Bantu languages. Are the Chadic languages a part of Bantu? I think Bantu and Chadic may be a part of the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And then the Khoisan languages down south are probably the ones that most people will have heard of. But, you know, then you go into the separate subgroups. So, like, there will be the Fulani languages in the west, Hausa up there. I think Hausa is Chadic. Good Lord, I can't remember this. I feel like a fool.
It's okay. You're still sounding smarter than any of us ever have.
Splendid. Everybody, please correct me on Twitter. The Bantu languages, like Swahili, is probably the most well-known Bantu language. And it's also probably got the least number of distinctive features of the Bantu languages. A lot of the Bantu languages have tone. Swahili lost it. Hmm. Chichewa is one that still has tone. It's from the east. And then the Khoisan languages in the south, those are the ones with the clicks. And they're, you know, clicks will show up like in various languages, usually in affective ways. So, you know, we have them in English, like... means you did something bad for some reason.
Right.
But the Khoisan languages are the ones that use them as speech sounds. And so I'm not going to pronounce it right, but the language that's spelled X-H-O-S-A is Osa.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's one of the famous ones. I think it has three clicks in several different series. So nasalized, aspirated, voiced, voiceless. I think they also have a palatal one.
Nasalized, aspirated voice, voices, nasalized, aspirated. We need to do some Schoolhouse Rock linguistic videos. I'm nasalated, and I'm also aspirated, and I'm sitting here on Capitol Court.
Why don't you just do it for Game of Thrones, and then you'll just make your viral video that you wanted so bad.
It's a really great idea. Actually, I wanted a viral language.
That would be really, really cool. If Schoolhouse Rock were still a thing, and maybe if they revive it, I would love to see them do some like basic linguistic stuff. I mean, you know, yeah, I do know now how to multiply by three, but I think it would also be cool if kids got some basic facts about languages.
I think what we should do is just make one and make it as complex as possible, but then set it to a, hey, everybody. Like, I saw that guy perform at Glendale once.
Oh, really?
No, it's not Dave Matthews. Yeah. He still performs, and he's filthy. He's nice. Absolutely filthy.
Really?
Yeah.
It's the whole Bob Saget thing.
It is. It's very Saget-esque. It's kind of Saget-y. But I can't remember the guy's name, but I saw him perform at a bar in Glendale once, and he sang some really dirty songs. But it's that voice. So you hear the voice, like, run, 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 your pussy. Like, it was just, like, the weirdest. It's just, like, the juxtaposition of those two things. What is the newest language that is fairly common? What's our youngest language?
Well, the youngest languages in general, if you go online, you can see all about this. One of the youngest languages they'll tell you about is Nicaraguan Sign Language. I think that's a bit of a complex issue. But anyway, if you're interested in looking at it, it's very interesting. Go take a look. But the youngest languages in general are Creole languages. What a Creole language is we can give you an example with... what was called Melanesian Pidgin English, which is now called Tokpising. What happened is that there would be a plantation, and then, at least I think I'm telling the story of Melanesian Pidgin English here. If not, it's another one in that area. What happened on this plantation, it was run by English speakers, and they would go and take able-bodied men from the various islands surrounding and bring them for a period of like 10 years and have them work and then send them back to their families. That area was so linguistically diverse that you were pretty much guaranteed to not get two people that would speak the same language. And so what happens is there's a bunch of men, because they'd only take able-bodied men, they wouldn't take women. There'd be a bunch of men on this plantation that would need to communicate. I mean, they're living there for 10 years. And so what happens is they don't actually teach them English. So instead, they kind of form what was known as a pidgin language. It has English vocabulary, but only the vocabulary. The grammar is kind of a mix of some of the languages that they spoke.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the language they know at this point. And so kind of grafted onto this is English vocabulary that over a period of, you know, say 50 or so years becomes like a mishmash where, you know, everybody's just, you know, everybody kind of speaks their own way, and maybe there's a lot of gesture that accompanies it, until after a long time this system kind of matures and becomes a full-fledged language. And at that point, it becomes a Creole language. And so if you take a look at Tokpising now, you'll be able to recognize a lot of the words as coming from English, but they won't mean quite what they meant in English. And the grammar is totally different. So that if you just listen to fluent Tokpising, like, you know, it's a completely different language.
Do you have an example?
I won't be able to do it right. Tokpising, by the way, the word Tok comes from talk in English, and Pising comes from business. It's like business speak.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. So Tokpising here, dispela maritama dispalasi. I think what I said was these women ate these leftovers. I believe that's what I said.
So these all had roots in actual words that we know
in English words. So dis, you know, this. Bella comes from fella. Mari comes from Mary. I don't know how that came to be the word for woman. And there's eat, im.
Could be religious.
Yeah, well, probably. I mean, you know, one would assume. But so then there's eat, which is eat. Im, which is him. Up, from up. Im, which is him again. And then we have dispelagin. And seat, which comes from shit. Because I guess that's the word for, that just came to mean leftovers. Dispelasi, you know, whatever's left over.
Just whatever kind of shit you can throw together.
So grammatically, though, like what happened is, especially with this verb, so we have, you know, idimapim, eat, when it became transitive, so like when you would eat something else, you would add eem on the end. It came from him, but it was actually a transitive marker. It marked the verb as having an object. But then we had up in there, so that kind of becomes a new verb form. So eating up becomes a new verb, and so you have to have the transitive marker on there again because there's an object, so eating up.
Oh, got it.
Do you know much about, I'm from, I grew up in Hawaii, and, okay. You know, Pidgin English is just, they were trying real hard. When I was growing up, they were trying real hard to make it into an official language.
Yeah.
It is basically just real bad English. And that's why, like, you know, Hawaii is, like, last in the country for English education, because even, a lot of the teachers I had growing up would still speak Pidgin English. And it was just, like, you know, to refer to something would just be dekine, like, grab me dekine.
Mm-hmm.
It's instead of like let's go over to your house, let's go stay your house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so,
yeah, what happens with that? Okay, so that's it's now called Hawaiian Creole English, and there is there's a continuum when it comes to Pidgin and Creole languages, right? And so with Hawaiian Creole English, the basilectal, the basilectal variety, the one that is most like, or that's closest to the source, is actually quite different from the lightest form of Hawaiian Creole English. There was a lot more Hawaiian in it.
Yeah.
But what happens is that Creoles, especially if the English is used as their lexifier languages, Creoles are going to end up resembling one another a lot. And so what happened, like, with Hawaiian, it took stay as its... how do you call this? Locative copula. Anytime that you have the word to be, but you're talking about it's some place,
yeah,
you'd use stay. And that's very similar to a lot of other Pidgin and Creole languages that use English as its lexifier. A lot of times they'll take something as their locative copula. I was trying to think of another one. I want to say de is a common one. But yeah, so, that's why you say like, you know, that guy needs to stay on table or something,
yeah,
as opposed to like, you know, he stay teacher, like,
yeah,
just, so anyway, the point here is that there's rules and systematicity to it. It's just different from English.
Yeah.
And really though, I think that in a situation of Hawaiian, I think recognizing it as a language would probably be for the best, because then you could, all you're pointing up is the fact that it's different from English. And so then it's like, well, you can learn this or learn this or learn both, right?
Yeah.
That way at least you can distinguish, as opposed to, you know, just treating it all
as
the same thing.
Do languages evolve from essentially accepted mistakes?
Oh, yeah.
Or just like, oh, these people didn't really know what that actually was, and so they just, it becomes like a mutation.
Well, because it was so many different cultures on the plantations, just like how he was talking about on the sugarcane plantations in Hawaii. So, and like, it's like basically, it's like you can track the language of Pidgin, Hawaiian Creole Pidgin or whatever, with the same as the food in Hawaii. Just as like the languages all got blended together, the food was also like, you know, there's like all the food in Hawaii is just basically like, you know, it's kind of Japanese, kind of Filipino, kind of American, you know, kind of Portuguese.
So it's essentially just as an outgrowth of the cultural mashup as anything else, clothes, food, everything else.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's
customs.
Like there would be, you know, you wear Aloha shirt, but you have Filipino pants.
Right.
You know, there was like a lot of that growing up.
Aloha shirt and Filipino pants.
Katie, can we get a time code on that?
Matt doesn't get to ask for time codes.
Here's the thing. With language, what happens is that people will use it, and then there will be innovations, and those innovations will slowly solidify until people don't recognize them as innovations any longer. Like, so you studied Latin then. Mm-hmm. You know where all the Romance languages got their future from. Remember, Latin used to have a dedicated future tense that didn't survive. If you look at any of the future tenses of a modern Romance language, like, you know, French or Spanish, if you look at them, you can actually separate them into infinitive plus a conjugated form of the verb to have.
Right.
Haber. And that's because what happened was people stopped using the future tense. It was too complicated, and instead used a form that was kind of like in English where you say, I have to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there they just started using that. And then it lost its obligative force. In English, it still has it. So you say, like, I have to eat now. It means I need to eat. It lost its obligative force and slowly coalesced and just became a simple future tense. And so now using it, say, comeré, I have to eat. Except that that now is being treated as too complex, and so it's getting replaced, at least in Spanish, by the go future. So now you say, me voy a comer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the way you say, I'm going to eat. Comeré has special uses now. And if things keep going, you know, probably die too.
Yeah, there are infinitive verbs in Italian too, where you like dare, or, you know, like some that you put in front of another, you know, like a verb to give it a specific meaning.
And you actually still have those in those languages, except that now, back then when it was Latin, of course, the conjugated verb would come at the end of the infinitive, which is why you have comer e in Spanish and not e comer. Whereas, like, now in Spanish you could say, like, I don't know, I have eaten, yo he comido, you know. Now it comes in the front.
Where does language go? Like, where do you think English is going to be in 50 or 100 years? I mean, is it...
Okay. Well, this is where I can benefit from the fact that I'm not a linguist who works at a university anymore. I don't have to be responsible. So I'm just going to say that I think that the level of communication that we have is going to prevent the kind of language change that we've seen in the past. Because there is always going to be motivation for people to want to have access to the stuff that we're producing right now and to be able to communicate with a wide, you know, diverse population. So it makes less sense for, you know, like American English to keep going and to become totally different from British English when you can be in constant and immediate contact with pretty much everybody all over the world at any time, if you want to be.
Yeah.
Right. And not only that, like, can you imagine if, you know, 100 years from now, we couldn't even understand the English of movies from the 1930s? That would be a real loss. And it seems like there's not going to be any point in time where suddenly all that material is lost for a long enough time that people won't care about it. I think people are probably going to be wanting to watch Casablanca for a long time.
Right.
So there's always going to be motivation, even if not economic, just cultural motivation to retain some form of the language as it exists. You know, slang always comes and goes. Like, and that's just going, it's ephemeral though. It's the deep structural change that really prevents, people from accessing older bits of a language. Like, you know, if you go to Chaucer, you can still kind of read it. But if you go to Beowulf, you can't read it. It's just a completely different language.
Has the internet accelerated, or has it decelerated the process? I mean, like, since we're all essentially a localized global community, has that sort of rooted the existing languages that we have from evolving too much because we're all communicated, like, we're not isolated and sort of going off all in our own directions anymore?
Well, that's kind of the idea. I mean, at least structurally. Of course, you know, new vocabulary is always going to pop up. New slang, especially on the internet.
YOLO.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, I had no idea what that meant. Or you know, another one I didn't know what it meant? SMH.
What's that?
Shaking my head.
Oh.
I've not heard that one.
We didn't know that either.
Really? Oh, man. Jump
text on. Speak. I feel like lead speak and text speak are going to fucking ruin everything.
Nah, nah, nah. Yeah, which is the fact that people say OMG now. They say it.
Right.
They don't say, oh my gosh, or oh my god.
WT fuck is that about?
Well, I know. But you know, if you go back to movies from like the early 90s or late 80s that show, like, you know, young teenagers using, like, all this slang.
Bitching.
Yeah. You know, they do stuff. It just goes. Like, now it almost seems like the shelf life of terms is even shorter, because suddenly people get, you know, they see it, they think it's cool, they start using it, then they immediately get tired of
it. Yeah, because their parents start using it.
Yeah, so like,
it dates things.
So RAD, I think, you know, was around for a while.
It's back.
Yeah. Oh, it's not.
RAD.
It is
I use RAD all the time.
I do, too. It's pretty rad. No,
and I use it pretty consistently.
I do, too.
It's fucking rad, David.
Yeah. You know what? I just ended it right now.
No, David!
No more.
That's not rad, David. Not rad.
Not rad at all.
Anyway, but like, think about like the Harlem Shake. I remember the first time I heard about that, it was like, oh, man, this is... I was just over to a friend's house, like, oh, you got to check out these videos. It's hilarious. These are the latest things. It was like, I think it was 2 days later.
That one
burned
fast.
People were already saying, like, you know, gosh, aren't you getting tired of the Harlem Shake?
That burned out fast.
Yeah. You see the same thing that's happening with terminology. It just becomes so uncool so quickly that it's just going to be a constant cycle.
So we're also addicted to innovation too. And I think not only do you see that with language, but with technology. And it's like, you know, oh, I have a phone, and 6 months later, I want a newer one. You know, it's like we're constantly trying to refresh. We've become a refresh culture. What is the most widespread language on the earth? Is it something like Hindu, or
do you want to, like, by numbers?
Yeah. Numbers, it would be Chinese.
Yeah, I think it would probably be Mandarin. Well, if want to lump in things like Cantonese into the umbrella of Chinese, which I think the Chinese government wants to do, but they're actually different languages. Probably Mandarin, but as far as lots of people just speak English, not necessarily natively, but as a second language. I mean, English is huge. But you know, your biggies are English, French, Mandarin, Spanish, and Japanese, I would say.
Well, I want to get a little before we, I think within the last chunk of time that we have, just sort of figure out. I want you to explain a little bit how you create, like, let's just take Dothraki, because I would imagine that most of the people listening to the podcast probably have seen Game of Thrones.
Right.
So, you know, where do you start with a language like that? Do you start with structure, or do you start with vocabulary, or do you look at the characters and go, they probably would talk like this based on their environment because of, you know...
All right, so Dothraki, of course, was a little different. It's like even different from High Valyrian, because there was a lot of material in the books, and they wanted to make sure that everything that was in the books would still remain correct after I had created the language. So I had to start there and look at what George R. R. Martin had, analyze it, figure it out, and then basically support it, build up a structure around it.
How'd he do with creating a language?
He did all right.
Oh, all right.
No, yeah, no, it's like, especially for his method, which was just to make it up on the spot, he did incredibly well. Most authors are terrible. Just awful, 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 awful.
What listening, that. Tolkien?
What makes a bad
Tolkien was good.
Shit,
Tolkien
if you
good.
Are, that's crazy.
He's with us.
He was good. He was a language creator first. Tolkien was. He created a whole bunch of languages and then decided, well, they need a place to be spoken, and so he wrote the books. It's true.
So the stories basically were just a justification for the languages.
Yes.
Jesus, that's fucking amazing.
Wow. Yeah. Anyway.
That's rad, David. There's no other word other than rad.
That's badical.
No,
I like it.
I use that too.
I like
rad
it.
Badical.
Bossa Nova. Chevy Nova? Anybody?
Chevy Nova. I'll use it.
Excellent.
All right.
All right. So then with that, you know, I had to figure out what it was. And then that determined a few things. For example, it determined that adjectives were going to come after verbs, that the word order was probably SVO, subject, verb, object. And so what it was painting the picture of was a head initial language. A head initial language where the relative clause will come after the noun that it modifies. The possessive clause will come after the thing. So it's why you say, you know, arachani, my, or arach, my, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, from there, it's kind of like, it was really just a matter of filling out the structure. And the same goes with the pronunciation, basically. I looked at all the sounds that he had in the books and then figured out what gaps there were. I think probably one of my only additions was ch. I just felt like it should be there based on everything else that was there. And then, you know, once I kind of filled out that structure, then it was just a matter of filling out the vocabulary. The vocabulary is where the cultural bits come in. You know, they... Where I figure out, you know, what type of technology they have access to, what a day in their life would be like, what types of things they would have a regular interaction with, and so what things they would have words for, what would be core vocabulary and what wouldn't. Anyway, and then, of course, for all of this, what I did was I went back and I engineered a proto-language, so a language that Dothraki would have descended from.
Oh, that's fucking awesome.
Yeah, you gotta do that. You gotta do that.
Yeah, you gotta do that. You gotta do it.
Yeah. We'll see.
You gotta give it a backstory?
Yeah, the natural languages, the way they are, it's like they're filled with irregularities and bizarre things. Like, you know, mouse, mice?
Yeah.
Completely explicable if you look at the history of English. At one time, it was completely regular. It was just moose, and then you add the plural E at the end. And so it was moose and moosey. But then because of the sound changes that happened throughout the years, moose became mouse and moosey became mice. And that's how you get that.
Oh, what the fuck?
Yeah, I know. English did that a lot. So, you know, in order to produce irregularities that look realistic and authentic as opposed to just random, you have to go back and engineer them to make sure. You just basically have to evolve them over a period of years to make sure that they look right and work right. And yeah, so that's...
So what was the Dothraki ancestral language?
I call it Proto-Planes. I don't know why, it just felt right. It's not like, you know, it has a name. That's, it, you know, it's... even in the context of the books, it is a proto-language in that nobody would have spoken it. I'm sorry, not that. Nobody in the world would know that it was spoken. So it is at some point in time way off in the distant past. So it's like a construct, as it were, as opposed to with High Valyrian, where High Valyrian itself is a proto-language for something like Astapori Valyrian. And then, of course, High Valyrian itself also had an earlier form, which I had to create, but that was the proto-construct. And then High Valyrian serves as the proto-language for Astaporian Valyrian and so on. Yeah, and that's kind of what I do.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it's fun.
Now, do you, you know, with fan sites online, are there people who have expanded the language using your rules, and have they done a good job, or have you seen stuff where you're like, nah, that's actually not...
No, they haven't expanded it. They've tried to... transcribe it as best they could, you know. So they I talk with the fans at all. They're like, you know, five of them, so but yeah, there's the Dothraki fan site, dothraki.org, and right now they're just putting together the dictionary for High Valyrian and Astapori Valyrian, and they're doing a pretty good job. Like one of the guys, I don't know if you would want me to give his real name or his handle.
His handle.
Mad Latinist. He does study Latin. He's been...
He just got an erection.
He's been studying, or he's been transcribing...
Durham.
Trying his best to transcribe all of the dialogue that was in season 3. And then, you know, as the season's gone on, I've also, put out information about, you know, how exactly it works. So, he's getting better and better at it. A friend of mine, actually, Christian Tomlin, he's another language creator. He was really good at figuring out what I was doing with a little amount of information. But you know, he's a language creator. I expect that.
are you a sleuth in the sense that you can hear a couple words from a language and then understand most of what that language is about structurally?
Probably need at least... You probably need a sentence. You know what? Yeah, a couple of sentences. Yeah, you can figure it out.
Do you think that the universal translator from Star Trek is realistic? Can you make one for me?
Wouldn't that be nice? All right.
Or the earworm from Hitchhiker's Guide.
much more realistic. I'm sure that animal exists.
Or just the TARDIS, which basically just naturally translates because you have a connection to it.
Who had the best one?
What?
Who are the best one out of the three of us?
Well, the earworm is a...
Hold on,
yeah.
Hold on.
Okay.
No, I
Yeah, okay.
Okay, no. So here's the thing with the Universal Translator. It is an amazing device because the way that it works, especially in the next generation, is just fascinating because they can turn it off somehow, magically. So, like, you know, Worf can say, the Klingon word for is...
Yeah.
And it's like, if that were really working... It should be like the Klingon word for bat is bat. Think about it. Yeah, if it were really working, that's what you'd hear. But so it's like you can like manually, and I don't know if it's the hearer or the listener who does this, they can just with their mind say, okay, now I want them to actually hear the language.
Right.
Yeah.
So you don't realize the universal translator, everybody's got one in their head.
Just implanted?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's ready to go.
Yeah, then they should never ever hear any other languages.
Yeah,
like in
either that or unless it's a Google,
right.
Unless it's a Google Glass type of thing, where it's like, you know,
yeah.
Or
I think it was just the writers were like,
Well, we should probably. This would sound really cool if there was Klingon here.
Sure.
How good is Klingon as a language?
Well, first of all, let me mention in the Next Generation, they didn't use any like actual Klingon beyond the first season. So I met Mark Okrand recently, and I'm a big fan of the Next Generation. So I was asking him about it, and he says like, "Well, I was doing work for Star Trek V, I want to say, and like as they were doing the Next Generation, they would ask me for translations, and they'd say how would you say this? How would you say this? And like he'd give them a translation. And then like it got to a point where like I kept on asking him, and he said like, yeah, I'm happy to translate for you on the show, but if you're going to keep asking me this, my agent is going to be happy unless you let him know. And we set something up formally, like, oh yeah, sure, absolutely, okay, we'll do that. And then like he never heard back from
us. Oh, jeez.
That's so, really funny. So it was
so
just
they just
a
bought
issue.
A copy of the dictionary and
yes,
tried the best they could.
That is exactly what they did.
Yep.
They had the dictionary had come out. They bought a copy of it. They did their best, and they just butchered it. Like everything, I guess, it's just not even close. It's disappointing.
I'm sure there's some sort of retcon explanation for why. Oh well, no, but this language, then there was this.
It's probably Ron Moore's fault, right? He wrote all those Klingon scripts.
What?
Ronald D. Moore. He wrote most of the Klingon-centric episodes. Anyway,
let's track him down.
I'm sure he invented the name Kalis, even though Kalis, there's no K in Klingon.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
Yep.
How they say their own name.
Some good episodes. It's the sound at the beginning of the word Klingon is actually an aspirated, let me get this right, it's an aspirated alveolar lateral approximate, or alveolar lateral affricate. So it's kla, kla.
Ah.
So it's not a K, it's a kla.
It's a Klingon.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Sounds real.
Yeah.
It's because it is, Jonah. It's real. It's in all of us.
Well, it's weird. I never really noticed the difference from like someone actually saying it on the show and just saying Klingon until just that moment right there where it actually is.
So now you're going to be a big fan of Next Gen?
No, probably not.
Okay.
Wait, are you not a fan of the Next Generation?
No, I'm not.
What on earth is your problem? It's television, and it's fabulous television.
Yeah, it's more like a stage play that's on TV. Real boring.
So it makes it great.
Yeah.
I like it.
No, I know. I'm sure it's great. I just
no, it's fantastic. Not my you're thing. Just being wrong right now. Yeah. I don't understand why you would.
You're just a 2.5 men kind of guy.
Yeah. No. Well, I mean, like it's kind of gone downhill. So I'm really into anger management right now.
Yeah. I'm on board with that.
Chuck Sheen is where it's at.
It's a stage play, so it's kind of boring.
That's the same problem I have with early Doctor Who. Hey, let's walk over there in real time.
Well, how are they going to know how they got
attention
out of the room?
Attention spans were different back then.
They sure were.
And budgets were lower.
Yeah. How do you say I have to pee in Klingon?
In Klingon? No, I have no idea.
Okay, go.
In Dothraki.
Pick any language.
Dothraki. Navilet. Navilet.
Wow, that is amazing. And that's what I have to do. I'll be right back.
They're going to people. Well, we're about wrapping up. This was our hour.
Oh.
If you want to just wait till the end.
Yeah, I can try. I've been waiting for.
I had to pee since beforehand.
I've had to pee since like 95, you guys. It's a guy who has to one up everyone.
Yeah. I have to pee too, the next level of terror.
I have to pee three, the search for Spock? No.
I had to pee before any of you guys thought it was cool.
You fucking piss hipster.
Yeah, I bet.
That's very Bossa Nova Chevy Nova.
You call me a pister.
I'm just trying to think.
Is there so where can people find you online?
Let's see. Well, you can go to Dothraki.com. I put up blog posts there. And then on Twitter, I'm stuck with this handle. I apologize. But it's Daedalus, and the U is spelled with a V. Daedalvs.
That's how the Romans would have carved it onto stone.
You bet it was. That's why I did it.
Roman Twitter, when they had the Roman Twitter wall.
The Roman Twitter wall.
You know, I got to tell you.
Oh, the Twitter wall.
At Socrates.
At Playboy Man says, Sarah, you look great. It's a way inside baseball.
At Socrates. I think you should go to the emergency room. That scene in my
At Two Brutes.
Sean Ray, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, at Brute.
Fantastic. The in Latin class, my third year Latin class, he showed us Life of Brian. Our professor showed us Life of Brian for that whole when he's writing when he's doing the graffiti and they're doing all
That's
the tenses, and we laughed so hard. when he's going through all the conjugations.
No, that was incredible.
The vocative! I'll slit your throat. How would you tell people enjoy your burrito in Dothraki? Do you have any idea? Do they have...
Well, like they must have a word for a small donkey. Do they have a word for a small donkey?
It's small donkey.
A small horse?
But a burrito, enjoy. Since it's tiny like, donkey, like a food app. But it means it's like it's a tiny donkey, yeah. But it's... Yeah.
But if there's like a if they have a food that's like
like the burrito. I want the translation.
No, but that's not. But it's used colloquially. It's used colloquially.
And how's it look? Maybe I'll leave it. Was that me? No, it was my. Okay, so how about this? And how's it look? Maybe I'll leave it. Gin burrito.
Hey!
Wow!
Won't fit on a shirt.
Probably not.
Get that tattoo, somebody.
And hey, guys.
What's happening now?
Let's bring Aramaic back, can we?
Aramaic?
Sure.
Hey, Mel Gibson tried his best.
That's a language, all right. It's Aramaic. Fallen.
It's been a while.
Sorry. Matt Sorry. Gopi.
Thank Sorry. You. I prefer Falling Down, Michael Douglas's movie.
Oh, I saw that.
Defense.
The Iron Maiden song that they did based on Falling Down was a disappointment, though, I will say.
No.
All iterations of Falling Down are a disappointment.
That entire era of Iron Maiden was a real disappointment. But, you know, Blaze Bailey, if you're listening, I think you're a fantastic gentleman. I really think the world of you, but I'm not a big fan of the recordings that you did with Iron Maiden. I apologize.
Ooh.
Throw down.
Shots fired.
I'm sure he's a good guy. I'm sure he's a good guy.
You just got yourself a Twitter war, son. At Daedalus with a V.
Radical.
He's probably a nice guy, too.
So, wait, say it one more time in Dothraki so I can repeat it.
Okay, wait. Burrito?
Enjoy your burrito, yeah.
Okay.
Syllable by syllable.
Unhazalak.
Unhazalak.
Meme alayafa.
Meme alayafa.
Yera. Gin burrito.
Gin burrito.
There you go.
Ah.
Do it all in a row.
I say we let him go.
No!
It's literally, I hope it pleases you, this burrito.
Oh.
That could be taken a lot of ways.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Nancy's love story could have been ripped right out of the pages of one of her own novels.
She was a romance mystery writer who happens to be married to a chef.
But this story didn't end with a happily ever after.
When I stepped into the kitchen, I could see that Chef Brophy was on the ground, and I heard somebody say, call 911.
As writers, we'd written our share of murder mysteries. So when suspicion turned to Dan's wife, Nancy, we weren't that surprised.
The first person they look at would be the spouse.
We understand that's usually the way they do it.
But we began to wonder, had Nancy gotten so wrapped up in her own novels...
There are murders in all of the books.
...that she was playing them out in real life? You can listen to Happily Never After, Dan and Nancy, early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.